It's working? Yeah, good. All right, we're going to get started because all the cool people are here, right? my name's Chris Hewitt, and I'm from Wild Mouse, which is a new company. And the name of the talk is Male Age 42 Happy. How many people know why that says 42? No? Mouse 42, right? Yeah. Okay. You can Google it later on if you didn't get it. Actually, I uploaded about a bazillion images of myself to howold.net, and I got between 46 and 66, so I picked this one. I guess the feature that is new in that is the happiness thing, which is just faked, sort of, but it can be done now. So what are we going to talk about today? It will come as no surprise to anybody that we're going to talk about three things, right? We're going to talk about, and it's basically, yeah, we're going to talk about analyzing text and speech. We're going to talk about analyzing faces and a little bit about videos. And we're going to talk about neural nets and NetSharp. And the reason we're going to talk about neural nets is because that's what ties all this together. That's what makes all this possible. At least it makes the it makes some speech analysis and image analysis possible. And the reason I'm here is talking at a Microsoft conference is because what Microsoft does is these are actually quite complex things. What Microsoft does brilliantly is to take these complex things and make them accessible for somebody as dumb as me, right? So even I can use... You know, I don't really understand the underlying technologies that are doing this, but I can use the APIs and I can achieve some quite spectacular results with just knowing how to push the buttons and stuff. And hopefully, what I'm going to do in this talk is show you where the buttons are, rather than, you know, you're not going to come out of here knowing how to build a neural net to do bloody blah, but at least you'll know where to go looking. As I'm going to do a lot of demos as we go through, I'm going to show a couple of slides and do a demo. Pretty much all the demos I'm doing are on the demos that you can just find on the internet, and some of you may have already gone and seen those or had a look at them. I've written code against these APIs, and I do have Visual Studio in the background here, and we may see some C# code. And right at the end, we're going to also look at a little bit of NetSharp code, although I'm not really a big NetSharp. I know enough to be dangerous in NetSharp, right? Let's say that. But if you do want to code, so we're going to see a few of the APIs from Project Oxford and a few other things. If you want to code to any of the Project Oxford APIs, you can go to that address and download the API for your favorite device. They're all... Yeah, I'm going to cover that later, but all the interfaces are REST, so you can use them from anywhere, pretty much. So you don't have to be using Microsoft tools or writing for Windows to use the features that are exposed by Azure ML Project Oxford. So the first thing number one, analyzing text and speech. And again, we're just going to start with the simplest, easiest thing to use. This is the main point about sentiment analysis. So this is it's in the Azure Marketplace. You just go and sign up for it. You pay 0.0001 cents per text analysis. I don't know exactly what it is. All it does is it takes text and, well, it does two things. The first thing it does is it takes text and it tells you what the sentiment of that text is. And if... You know, for certain applications, that's something you want to do. And effectively, there are four lines of code that you need to put into your application in order to achieve this. That's all it takes to do that. And so who would use it? Like if you're running a hotel booking site and you've got reviews, that's the classic. I mean, this thing is trained, I think. I don't know exactly what it's trained on, but I get the feeling it's trained on tweets and reviews from hotels and restaurants and things. And it generally works. I mean, it's trained with a lot of data, and it generally works pretty well. You give it any kind of text, and it'll give you a reasonable sentiment analysis. Some of them are amusing, as hopefully we'll see in a short while. And the other thing that the text API does is it does key phrase detection. So given that piece of text that we got sentiment analysis for, it it tells you what the key phrases are in that piece of text. The use of that is that you can then, you know, say it's not just for one piece of text, but you've got 100,000 hotel reviews. What you can do is you can then deploy other data analysis techniques to go, okay, what are the things about a hotel that make people like it or hate it? And you can, you know, and so it's a simple API with probably quite a complex model behind it with huge amounts of training data. And if you understand what it does, you can use it to do a certain subset of things. But I guess the point is that it's really easy. I'm going to put my glasses on in case of it. Let's see. Oh, we're getting ahead of ourselves here. Okay. All right. So, as I said, I'm going to do demos mostly just in Edge here. So this is the demo for the text analytics service that we've just been talking about. And I'm going to answer one of the two of life's great questions, right? So the first one is, what happens if I say, I love Melbourne? All right. Okay. All right. Enormous amounts of data science have gone into deciding that the sentiment for that statement is 82%. All right. How many people are from Melbourne? Yeah. Sydney? You know what I'm going to do next, right? Yeah. Okay. So Melbourne, 82%. Sydney? Right. 86%. So we've answered that question once and for all, right? Okay. but before you all get to celebrating too much, Gold Coast beats both of them, right? and, you know, just for our international listeners, we're going to do the other one, right? Los Angeles? 79%, all right. So you know what I'm going to do next. Any guesses? Yeah, actually, this one's more obvious than the last one. 93% for New York, so, all right. Yeah. And you can see, actually, just down at the bottom there that it's picked out the key phrase, and this is New York. So the reason that they're different is that just in the training, tweets or reviews or other pieces of text that were used for training this model, they tended to be more positive if they had the word New York in them than if they had the word Los Angeles in them. So that's all that we're seeing here. Yeah, it seems pretty, because actually it's kind of surprising that those things, which are effectively the same piece of text, are different, but that's why, because those words have a weight in terms of sentiment. All right, let's just move on. So, I guess the end of that is it's four lines of code. You add it to your application. If you need to do sentiment analysis or do data analysis of, and you can do batches, right? Or do data analysis of a huge number of pieces of text, then you just call the text API. It doesn't cost very much to use these things, and compared to the amount of work you would spend a couple of months building this yourself. You could build this yourself. You'd spend a couple of months building it. You'd need to have a whole lot of good training data, and you know, in the end, it probably wouldn't be as good anyway. So what you do is you just use this thing out of the marketplace. That's what I'd do. However, sometimes it isn't good enough, right? And especially since, you know, we don't really know exactly what it's been trained on, and you might have a specialized area. So we might be talking about, we want to classify things in different ways. So the one that we looked at before did was it did sentiment analysis, positive, negative, and it extracted the key phrases. You might want to classify text in some other way. You might have a whole lot of learned papers and you want to put them into topics or something. It won't do that for you. But what there is the text classification template, which is basically you do it yourself, but you don't have to start from zero. So there are already models there that know that are quite good at classifying text. What you have to do is supply the training data. So you supply data that says, okay, things that look like this are about, or let's say it's news, classifying news. Things that have these kind of things, well, these things are about world news, and these things are about Victorian news, and these things are about Queensland news. You train it up with a few thousand, or hopefully a few hundred thousand of those. You know, the point about this is that when you're training it, you want to train on the biggest data sets that you can possibly give it. And then once it's trained up, it'll know how to classify those things. What else can that do? It does. If we actually go to the template, it will tell us what it does. So I'll just flip over to that. All right. Blah blah blah. So you know, we're not really going to get into it, but it's basically a it basically trains you how to do text classification, and amongst the things that you can do is sentiment analysis. It doesn't really say that here. Actually, it does, but not. Sentiment analysis. You can read it all yourself. What am I going to do with this thing? Is this email spam? These are just some suggestions. Pretty much, you can do. What it does is it's a pipeline, a pre-designed pipeline with models in it that lets you classify text, and text that's specific to your problem domain. Okie dokie. I like the little brain with the weights. It's good. Okay, so the next topic is the speech API. And I was going to write words on here or come up with something, but basically this is a case where the icon pretty much tells you what the thing does, right? It converts speech to text and text to speech. And it doesn't really do... It doesn't do anything more than that, but it does it really, really well. Hopefully that's the next thing. Okay. That didn't work very well. Thankfully I've got... Yeah, the problem is that I've changed my... that's better. Now, the first thing I have to do here is I have to change my language. We don't have English AU as an option, but for me anyway... English GB works a lot better than English US. So I wonder if this is going to work. Use my microphone, yep. The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. It's pretty good. That's not good. Never work with animals or speech to text engine. Right? Yeah, okay, however, I will leave the ha 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 in for the next bit. And the other thing it does is it lets you. There's only one voice for Australia, so we'll just use that one. Ooh, what was that? I must have copied too much. Okay.
The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. Ha ha ha.
Nice. Okay. Right. What's the point of that? Well, this is just a web interface to it. But again, there's a REST API for it. You can add this to your applications. You can add speech recognition and speech from text or speech from whatever. You can grab text out of a database and you just call this API and it does a conversion for you. You don't have to include anything in your app. Why is that important? Well, it works on any device. So it's going to work on your fridge. It's going to work on your car. It's going to work as long as it's connected, right? Everything has to be connected. It's going to work on your phone. It's not just your PC that we're targeting here. We're targeting all these things. And you just make a REST call to this thing. Pass it stuff, it sends back the results. And we're going to see, it's not the individual, each of these features, somebody spent a long time building these features. Each of them is not that huge, but the thing is that you can use them together, as we're going to see shortly, something that you could use with this. The audio input, sorry?
Is it just a file?
Yeah, it's a... Do I have code for that? No. It's a Yeah, it's just an audio file eventually. It's going to be, yeah. I guess we could go and look at that page, or you could go and look at that page. Yeah, this is my CTO. With my CTO hat on, I'm going, yes, it probably works something like this. Why don't you go and have a look at it and and tell us? Okay. Yeah, from memory, you make a memory stream out of a piece. Actually, it does it asynchronously, and it can do it in segments. So you notice that when I was talking, it was doing it a chunk at a time. So there was like a pause. So it was actually sending, a second at a time to it, and then going back and correcting. So yeah. You're right, the call, that's slightly more than 4 lines of code. It might be 8 lines of code behind a speech recognition bit. This is a cool one that doesn't exist, right? We can't show you this one because the beta is, it's announced, but the beta is not available for a few weeks, a couple of weeks probably, maybe 4 weeks. What it does is it recognizes a speaker, which could be extremely exciting, except that it's not totally, you couldn't use it to log into your phone or, like you're thinking, oh, that would be great. Like, if it was good, what you could do is instead of, typing 4 numbers into your phone, you could just hold up your phone and go, hey, phone, and the phone would come alive because it would know it was you. It's designed to be used for light authentication. And the kind of thing that we're talking about here is that if we're on a conference call and there's 10 people on the call, it can be, you can take the stream of audio that's in the call and pass it to this API, and it will tell you who is speaking currently, or voice 1, voice 2, and you can put names to it. So, of course, this is just an API. What they want you to do is they want you to build applications that use these APIs. So if you're building, Skype or something like that, and probably that's what it's going to be used for, right? So you're in Skype and you're doing a conference call, and you say this is Chris and this is Bruce and this is John. It will use this feature to identify the currently speaking voice. And there are, it's a feature. It's really up to us to decide what we can use it for. In fact, it probably exists because of Skype, but we can use it for other things. There's another one, actually. Yeah, that's a good point. And it's sort of, I should have said it back on speech API. There's another feature which is in our private beta at the moment called Custom Recognition Intelligence Service. And what that's for is that the speech recognition works okay if I speak clearly and I pick the right language. So if I picked English US, the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog might not have worked out quite so well. And sometimes people have to speak in noisy environments. Sometimes the people speaking are 5-year-old children. And so it's called CRIS, a good name for a feature. What this feature, CRIS, does is it allows you to train up your own speech recognition for your own particular application. So if the one that we looked at before, Speech API, is a generic speech API. It works in, I think currently it works in Mandarin and English. I guess it would be Chinese and English, really. It probably works in both. Soon it'll be working in Spanish. By next year there'll be 12 languages supported. But it's recognizing the average speaker in those languages. And so there are applications where it won't work very well. Kindies. I don't know, why are we doing speech recognition in kindy? I don't know. But say we wanted to, then we would probably have to train a model to understand those children, which makes me think, I wonder if it's possible to understand baby talk. Wow. Okay, project for somebody, not me, too busy. the next thing we're going to look at is LUIS, the Language Understanding Intelligence System. Let's just call it Language Understanding. What it lets you do is it lets you take natural language recognition and use it in your own application. So like you've got an MVC model or something, you want to know about entities and actions. Lewis is a machine learning feature that allows you to pass text to a service, and that service is powered by your model, and your model, which is tuned to your application, and it tells you what action it thinks is intended here, and what entities this action is going to go against. Now, you know, I was saying that these things go together. So Lewis is one thing, and the speech API or Chris are other things. So you can take the speech recognition features, put them on top of Lewis, and then your Windows phone, or actually, okay, your iPhone, your Android, your Windows phone, your fridge, right? Your Android fridge, for example, can understand what you're saying to it as a command. So that's the kind of thing that, so, you know, Lewis is good, but we don't really want to be typing stuff on keyboards anymore. So what you do is you have speech recognition on the front and then Lewis behind that, and what you can do, yeah.
How do you train it and how does it get better?
Lewis, we're going to do that. Okay, that's a good question. And in fact, I was pretty much finished there, so let's go to have a look at it. Here's one I trained earlier. I don't want to sit here and, this is minor, it takes a few seconds to train something like this because I don't have very much data in here. But this is a Lewis application called 2001. And what it knows about, the only intent, or the intent is like action, right? The only actions it knows about are don't do anything and open. And the only things it knows about are Dave, Hal, and Pod Bay doors. Actually, that's not entirely true, because I can't do it without breaking this. I'll show you in a minute. I've added a couple of pre-built entities. Bravely, I added Encyclopedia. Not that there's any danger to it, but just Encyclopedia is huge, and it picks up a lot of interesting stuff. And date time, and that means that my model knows about the things I told it about. It also knows about everything that's in the encyclopedia, which is a lot of stuff, and it knows how to interpret date time type constructs. So again, no code for this. This is you just get this in the box, or we can test it by just hitting enter on this. So I've got a query that my text example is Hal open the flappy in out things today. Now previously I have taught this model that flappy in out things are actually pod bay doors, right? So hopefully if I hit this, we'll see some results. So hitting this right, like that's not what you do. What you do is you have four lines of code in your application, and you call a REST interface passing Hal open the flappy in out things today, and you get this JSON back. And what this says is my model has decided, and it's my model, it's not a generic model, it's my particular model. My model has said, I think this means, I'm pretty sure it means that they want to open something. And the things I found in this were a date time called today, which is like the 17th of the 11th of 15. Another entity that I know about in this model called Hal. And also, I found another thing in the encyclopedia. I found a person called Hal. So person is sort of a fairly broad term. I guess this means that in the encyclopedia, AIs in fiction are defined as people. Who am I to argue with our overlords? Yeah, so, and it also found that flappy in-out things are pod bay doors. I guess we better figure out why that happened, because it's like pretty stupid, isn't it? The reason that happened is because when I was putting, there's very little training data in here. Come on, work, you devil, work. Yeah, all right. You know, I've only put in 5 utterances to train it. Normally you would train this on as many things as you need to. You can just put in new things and then you can say, what does it mean? So at some stage I said, hey, Hal, open the flappy in out things. And I just, well, let's do it. What would Hal say to Dave, or what would let's say he's a good AI, right? I'm opening the doors now, Dave. I should really recognize some of this already. So this is training it, and you know I'm doing it using UI. You can actually do it using code as well. You can train it using code. So it's found the doors in the encyclopedia. Can I take that out? No. Okay. I'm going to say, yeah, you know, this is why it's better not to, have the encyclopedia in there, maybe. Opening? No, it's already worked out that it's open. Dave? Okay. Dave is Dave. All right. The doors is probably the band, right? I think that this would be a good idea to get rid of encyclopedia. We won't do it now. And in order to make that work, I'd have to train it. So I'd put in, you know, 10s or 20s or 50 or 100 utterances. For this sort of thing, you're not really talking about thousands, because we're just talking about a little application that runs on your fridge, or an application that runs in your car. So we're building a Raspberry Pi Windows 10 double DIN thing that runs in your car, and we let it have voice control. There might only be a couple of hundred things that you want it to do. You put in a certain number of utterances, not millions. You label them. You have to go through each one and say, like, this word means this. It actually does guess, so you don't have to you don't have to put in every different kind of utterance that could possibly go in. You just say, when they say this kind of thing, it means that. It means do this action on these entities. And if it sees something similar to that, it'll guess, yeah, it's probably this action on these particular entities. So this is actually quite useful if you want to put natural language control into your app. All right, let's keep moving right along. That was a good one, though. So analyzing speech is a hard problem, and by this we're not talking about speech to text. We're talking about the difference between "I hate you" and "I hate you," right? Same words, completely different meaning. Yep. I'm not going to go back and do it, but yeah, you can actually see when there's an error. You can actually mark things as errors, and you can retrain. It basically retrains itself all the time, and you can go back to the UI, or you can send things to the batch interface to change it. Right. So, all right. The correct answer is, it learns. You can teach it. You can tell it things. But like, that's further than I've gone with it, right?
Within your app, you would actually build out the error correction functionality, right? Where
now this is the problem with me going so broad, because now I'm thinking, yeah, probably if I went and had a look at that API, there'll be a method that you call to do that, but I don't know. So all I'm saying at this level is what it does in general. And so it sounds like people want to put natural language understanding into their fridges, so that's a good thing. Use this, it's the best thing out there. Right. This is that problem, right, which is not the words that you're saying, but what is the emotion behind those words? And it's a difficult problem. Solved, of course, with neural nets, as we'll see later on. But let's listen to this little snippet.
Well, thank you very much. A little while ago, I met with the Prime Minister and advised him that I would be challenging him for the leadership of the Liberal Party. And I asked him to arrange or facilitate a meeting of the party room to enable a leadership ballot to be held. Of course, I've also resigned as Communications Minister.
To let it go to the end. Now, analyzing the emotion in audio, or human voice, is not a current feature of Project Oxford, although, and I don't know anything about what they're planning to do, although I do know that there are a number of Microsoft research papers about this. In the meantime, there's a really clever and incredibly rich now company in Israel called Beyond Verbal that people keep throwing money at. So I took that piece of, and they use, you know, they use, I don't know exactly what they use, but I'm pretty sure they use neural nets, at least in part. None of these things are done just with a neural net. They're neural net and other things downstream. But if you take that piece of text and send it to Beyond Verbal, it tells us that, well, just look at the last bit. It tells us that the primary emotion that he's showing there is hope, and the secondary emotion is loneliness, which is kind of, it actually makes sense. This is a new field, right? These guys are probably the best at this at the moment. But yeah, it's basically a problem that is amenable to solution, right? We will be able to, and we'll keep getting better at working out from what people, how people are saying things, what emotion they're having. So, you know, basically this is about your fridge knowing if you're angry that there's no milk or something. The uses for these things are really up to the imagination of the of you guys, right? But we can do this sort of thing now. I suspect that soon you'll be able to do this sort of thing in Microsoft Project Oxford. Don't know, suspect. And it could be quite useful. So we're going on to faces. So this is the second part. How are we going? I've got to go faster. That's right, because we're really not going to do very much in Face API. Let's go over to off Lewis. So Face API, you guys probably have looked at it before. It's what's behind howold.net. I'm not sure whether they actually call it, because they have the option of using the underlying models themselves if they want, because they have the models available. But it gives you back information about, it finds faces in, we're just going to look at this one, it finds faces in pictures. It creates a whole bunch of landmarks, so where a whole bunch of things are in this face. And it tells you the gender and age. Actually, it's capable of telling you other things that now that aren't in this UI. But if you want, you can go back to, I'll remind you of this, you can go back to the SDK and see what it is that you can do with that. While we're there, you know what? Let's just upload something. There is something I can say about this. If I upload this picture of Fry and Laurie that I happen to find lying around, okay, it'll detect. It's probably about right for the age. The age detection, it doesn't, you know, it's not trained on the actual ages of people in the pictures. It's trained on how people perceive the age of the people in pictures. And that's quite a different thing. And there's a bunch of psychology around that. So, for example, anybody between about 20 and 35, they really have only three ages that they know. There's my age, old, and kids, right? So, and actually, it turns out that, like, the older you get, the better you get at actually estimating ages. So they should train this thing only using input from old people, right? And also, as we've noticed with howold.net, they never trained it on babies. So you put a baby through howold.net and it comes out as age 22 or something, or 76, but just because they didn't have a lot of babies in the initial training data. There's no other point in this. And while we're here, we've got to look at mymoustache.net. So I've got to point you guys at this. This is a Microsoft Garage project by the lads, and if you have a moustache, if you're anybody growing a moustache for Movember, okay, what you can do is upload your photo to mymoustache.net, and it will rate your mo against other people in the world. Neither of these, well, actually, it's detected a vague moustache on Laurie, and definitely Fry is clean-shaven. It's hard to tell that, but it thinks there's a bit of a moustache there. If you upload a picture of yourself without a moustache, you can always see what you would look like with one, and that's using those facial landmarks to work out where on the picture your nose and eyes are, and then it draws a moustache on. So you can upload your picture and see what you would look like with one of those. And then you can give money to Movember as well. So that's mymoustache.net. All right. And I'm not going to talk any more about that. Dogs don't work. Face API does not actually recognize dogs. We'll see later on. It does recognize cartoon faces. It doesn't recognize dogs, which is sad because I really wanted to know more about this dog because I thought it was a great picture of a dog. And I just drew those face landmarks on myself. What we're talking about is how we analyze facial expressions. So there's a bunch of things. So I actually tried to build something using facial landmark positions because, I'm slightly technical. So I got facial landmark positions for a whole bunch of training images from Face API and tried to build a model that would use that to work out what the emotions were, and it kind of worked a little bit, but not particularly well. Later on, we're going to see that facial action coding system is, for the last 20 years, how you define technically facial expressions in people. But now, now that we have, later on we're going to see why, now that deep neural nets are a good idea, there's a different way of doing this. That's all I want. Really, I just wanted to show you a picture of the dog. All right, who's seen Inside Out, the movie? Anybody seen Inside Out? It's a fantastic movie. It is aimed at 8-year-olds or whatever, but it's still very funny. These are actually the accepted universal emotions. So emotions that most people accept are universal across all members of the human race, non-culturally dependent. There's arguments about them, basically happiness and sadness are always going to work. Contempt is Japanese contempt different to Anglo-Saxon contempt? I don't know, really. But these are the ones that are accepted. There are actually, many, many more. I'm not even sure I want to go. I won't even go to the link to that. The link is, you need to look up, if you want to know more about this, you look up Paul Ekman, who's the guy that defined this. but yeah, so these are the accepted universal emotions. This I just put up because I thought it was a really pretty picture and it's Creative Commons, so I could. I actually think this is an anti-pattern because, it's as a programmer, I look at this and go, oh, that's great. You've got grief against ecstasy and sadness against joy, and it's all balanced but the real world isn't like that. So in a way, it's an anti-pattern. You try, because we like symmetry and we like things like this, we try and classify the world like that. A neural net doesn't see the world like that at all. It sees it as a much more complex thing, which is good because the world is not this simple. Right? But and also the other thing that I can say about this slide is that most of these emotions aren't actually amenable to understanding through facial or audio analysis. Right? We can't tell. We can probably get fear, and fear is going to be very useful, I think. So the Emotion API, what it does is it uses Face API's face finding bit. Again, I'm not sure whether it actually calls it, but it uses the model that detects faces from Face API, and then it has its own. It's a convoluted neural net that it uses to detect the emotions. It was built I suspect it's been built in the last couple of months, or you know, it didn't take them very long to build it. And it was released last week, along with the paper from Microsoft Research that talks about you know, what's behind it, if you were at all interested. What interests me is that it works. And I guess what the team would like me to say is that they're very pleased at the speed that they can turn basic research into deployed applications, like really, really fast. Because they're reusing neural nets that were previously purposed for other things. And that's one of the features of neural nets, is that you've got one that works for recognizing digits, you know, handwritten digits. It will also, you know, with a few changes and some training, it will also recognize handwritten characters. So when you build a nice complex neural net, you can use that design for many different purposes with the correct training. So there is a bunch of, before Emotion API came along, you know, there are actually quite a lot of commercial services that will determine emotions from videos and faces. You can use Emotion API in videos, because videos are just you know, a bunch of images. So what you can do is you can take every nth image from a video, put it through Emotion API, and get the emotion, say, of the room, right? So hopefully not boredom. And they, as I understand it, they don't tell you exactly what they do, but as I understand it, what they've been doing is using fax encoding. That's the facial activity thing that we were talking about before, that's been around for about 20 years. Then doing feature extraction, and then they're passing that to ML models, not necessarily neural nets, that do the classification and say, this person's happy, or this person's 12% happy and 50% sad. Now, the people that do this have got, like, you know, lots of patents and, you know, millions of dollars spent on R&D and whatever. But if we have a look at the results we're getting from Emotion API, I should have uploaded that picture. That picture is really cool. I'm going to go back to, I'm just going to go back temporarily to here and show you something cool. Right, I'll load up that image, which is where, okay. Actually, I should load it up to Emotion API, shouldn't I? No, not face demo. Yeah, let's load it up to, there's another case where when I first set this up, all right, let's upload that picture to emotion recognition. That's where it's called. Right, the interesting thing here is that it detected the face. It didn't detect those guys, because they've got, well, that guy could have been detected, but he's got sunglasses on. It's probably why he's not there. And also his face is a little bit too far on the side. But it detected the tattoo. Check that out. And so we can have a look at, the girl is 99.5% happy. Okay, so this is, yeah, this is a party, so that's good. And the tattoo is mostly neutral and a bit sad. I thought that was funny when I saw that. Okay, back to Excel. And that's pretty much what that says there. That's not the point. The point of this is I should just click this one at a time, right? Right. The point is that the blue, click up one, that the one at the top is the analysis of this image from Emotion API, and at the bottom, the analysis from probably the leading commercial emotion analysis thing. So these guys spent millions of dollars, you know, many years, you know, lots of patents working out how to do this, not with neural nets. And these guys come along. Now, admittedly, there's quite a lot of complex thinking behind Emotion API, but the implementation is not strange, and there probably aren't any patents on it at all, and it took them a few months, right? And I reckon that Yeah, because this is saying that this girl has a mixture of emotions, and this one's saying, yeah, she's happy. I reckon Emotion API wins this one. Also, while we're here, there's probably another one. And there's another point I can make too. So yeah, same thing. This is one of the, I had to buy these images to, I have to use these images because I had to buy them to train the model that I was building. So Emotion API says, yeah, pretty much totally happy. And the competition says, yeah, I'm mostly happy, a bit surprised. I don't think she looks surprised. Does she look surprised to you? Not to me. And then one more thing, maybe. Yeah, this one. So the same person. Now, the thing is that these are actors. And you know they've been paid to do faces to get their photos taken so that somebody can sell them. People don't know how to fake sadness. Like, so this says, this person is this expression is neutral. And it's the same with all of the sad photos that I bought. None of the tools that I put them through think they're actually sad. They all think they're neutral. So it's easy for us to fake happiness, and it's hard for us to fake sadness. I don't know whether that's useful to anyone, but that's a discovery I made. Okay, back to the slide deck. We're going to be here forever, aren't we? Right. Well, no, we're probably in good time. So the future is here now. The more training, basically we know how to do lots and lots of things now because they're not that hard. They're hard, but they're quite doable. What we need is we need lots of data. We need lots of grunt, and we need some reasonably sophisticated algorithms that we're going to see soon. And the deep neural nets are good at, we're going to see what they are soon, can do lots of different things. And with the stuff that we've got now, what sort of things can we get up to? All right. I wrote down a few. I mean, because you just think of them as they come along. Yeah, market research uses this now. So people doing market research, they do a new ad, they actually show it to people with webcams on, and there's software that you can buy that analyzes how people are reacting to your ads. And you know, games, right? That like I think there's some feature in Xbox that can tell whether people are enjoying the game or not, or what they like, or yeah, maybe it's a market research version. Right, it's not spying on you. Security, okay, so the kind of things that you could do with security. So, for example, if you were a bar and there were people that were excluded, you could just set up a little camera by the door and it just takes a photo of everybody that goes in, passes it up to face recognition and beeps when somebody excluded tries to come in the door. Right? So bars would buy that. You know, it's not going to cost them much. Every time you send a picture up to Face API, it costs you 0.0001 cents. And by the way, you don't really need to upload high definition pictures. It'll probably work fine on anything. As long as you've got 200 by 200 pixels, that's all you really need. So if you are going to do something with Face API or Emotion API, before you send it up there, you don't need to send the full drama of everything you got off your phone camera or whatever. You cut it down to a couple hundred pixels by a couple hundred pixels and then send it up. And in fact, I'm pretty sure, I don't know this, but I suspect that one of the first things it does is makes it grayscale. So, you know, to save bandwidth, you could make it grayscale first. It'll probably still work just as well. now, you know, that we can detect fear. We can detect fear in people's voices. We can detect fear in people's faces to a certain level of you know, how well we can do that. It's not 100%. It's not even 80% yet. It'll get better over time. So Emotion API, you know, probably detecting happiness, it's pretty good at, because happiness is, you know, your mouth goes up and this happens. Fear is probably a bit harder to detect. But given that you can detect fear in people's voices and their faces, if you were a clever government and you had border controls, you could just set up a camera as people are walking through customs and see which ones are afraid and go, let's search that guy, right? Now, you know, we want them to do that. It sounds a bit scary, right? But don't we want our government to do that? I don't think they are. Yeah. on sound. We just did a demonstration of a non-Microsoft product that works on sound, right?
So yeah.
Sounds that machines make. The toolkit lets you do anything, but you need to be trained. So the beyond verbal thing is trained on people's voices, right? Not on what they're saying, but on the I don't actually know, pitch, on the complex details of what's inside the audio from people's voices. You could train it to hear. So we're thinking of things like, say you're driving your car, right, and there's a funny sound from the engine, right? You could actually have a machine that would know that was the such and such going, right? So yeah, you could do that. There isn't anything like that at the moment. I'm not going to go on. You basically use your imagination. One of the things that we're looking at doing for an education project is just taking language and detecting bullying. So it's for children talking to each other in chat rooms, right? Detecting language which might be considered to be bullying. That's the kind of thing you can do. Let's just move on. I'll just skip through this quickly. There's a program, Lie to Me. I don't think it's on anymore, but it's about people who can tell whether somebody's telling the truth or not. People like that actually do exist. There's a very small number of people, and they don't always know when people are lying. So, whether that's 60% or 50% or whatever, people aren't really good at telling if someone else is lying when they're standing in front of them. There's a very small percentage of people that can tell. Now, given that people can do it, it's actually possible for us to build a machine that can tell 85% of the time whether somebody's lying and can do it better than you. So I don't know whether you'd buy one of those if I was selling you one. And you'd just use, you'd use the facial expressions and the transitions. You'd use some micro expressions that are tells, and you'd use voice analysis. You could do this and you could come up with an estimate of whether the person that you're talking to is telling the truth, and you could put that on your phone, right? Because the reason you can put it on your phone is because the processing is not happening on your phone. What you would do is you would take the little bit of video with the audio and you would pass it up to, you'd probably actually downsample it, because like we said, we don't need all of those pixels. You downsample it, pass it up to a service that'll come back, hey, that was a lie. Or I'm 75% certain that was a lie is more like what it is. But some people are always going to be able to get past that, because in the same way that there are a few people who can spot lies, there are also a few people who can tell them really well. The last topic is neural nets. And the reason that we're talking about neural nets here is because neural nets are a feature that works on problems that are hard to featureize, like classifying faces or working out the emotions behind audio, less on language, right? Language, neural net maybe not so much. It'll do it. It's just basically it's images that neural nets work on best of all. And audio works too. And then the other good thing is that they're really easy to use. You don't have to featureize things to give it to a neural net. Neural nets don't work for everything. They work for a subset of problems that we've got. But when we can use them, they are easier to use than other types of model. And they've been around for ages. I can actually remember in the 80s, so now I'm revealing how old I am. Back in the 80s, I can remember working with neural nets. We were trying to work with them in natural language understanding back in the 80s. So they've been around for ages, and they're not that much different. They're a little bit better than they used to be. The reason that they're a topic over the last 5 years is because now we have the grunt to make them work. Now we have the data to train them. They needed, thousands, tens of thousands of CPUs, and they needed millions of annotated pieces of training data. Now we have that. We can build neural nets that We can build neural nets that can do interesting things for us. By the way, you've all got one, or at least it's possible to build a model on top of neural nets that accurately models how your eyes work. So at one level, your eyes are sort of powerful, but actually quite simple. There's a lot of stuff there, but it's not all that complex. And your eyes actually get trained in the same way that a neural net gets trained. So you might notice that you can't see your nose, right? Why? Your nose actually takes up 20-25% of your field of vision, but you can't see it, right? Have a go. Well, you can cross your eyes and see it, right? But, just in the natural order of things, you don't see it. And that's because, basically, your eyes are from, about 0 to 6 months, train themselves to completely ignore that big thing that's sitting in the middle of their field of vision. All right. And that's kind of how neural nets learn stuff. Do we care? I don't know. At this point, yeah, maybe. We're going to have a look at a few. Effectively, for any of the problems, any of the kind of problems that we're talking about, recognizing emotions, seeing how old somebody is, you're really going to be talking about something that's reasonably complex, so using convolution and pooling. It's worth doing. Anybody use Azure ML? Okay. If you're in Azure ML, there's a model over there. There's a couple of them, but like multi-class neural net, and you can drag that on, train it up with some data. Now, I don't know if you've tried different things. Like, if you were trying to predict, like I was, who was going to win AFL games or something, the neural net was okay, but not particularly good. The neural net is much better at doing things like recognizing things, finding Wally, right? Yeah, that's what you're using. In Where's Wally? Finding Wally is what you'd use a neural net for. The one hidden layer one is pretty much the thing that you just drag and drop and don't think about. In order to make anything more complex than that, you need to use a DSL. And the domain-specific language for defining neural nets is NetSharp. And NetSharp is quite a sophisticated language. It includes lambdas. There's none here, but it's actually a cool little language. And what it does is it lets you define those kind of complex neural nets that you need to classify your documents into whatever it is that you want to classify them into, to find. In fact, after this, I think I'm going to go and try and build myself a Wally finder, to solve Where's Wally problems. If you want to find Wally, you're probably going to use a convoluted neural net, not necessarily particularly deep. And if you want to do that, you need to write it in NetSharp. So we're coming to the end, don't worry. In fact, this is almost the last thing I'm going to do, is we'll just have a look at what's in here. This is too confusing and complicated for everybody, isn't it? Why don't we go and look at a simpler one? Oh, it had to happen. While I've been sitting here, my session is timed out, so I've got to wait for a second. I've got to log in. Okay. No, it knows who I am. No. Is that workspace? No, I don't want to copy an experiment from a gallery. Yeah, something bad happened, but I'm recovering. So, yeah, let's just have a look at one hidden layer. So normally you'd go down, you'd go over here and you would, you could pick, because what we're trying to do here is classify. What the data sets that we've got here, this data set is a data set of handwritten numbers 0 to 9. And we've taken 60K of them and used it. They're labeled, so we know what they're supposed to be. 60K of them are used to train whatever model we're training, and 10K of them have been used to check or to score the model. And here we're using a multi-class neural net. Now, when I just drag on a multi-class neural net. So it's under classification. That's it. When I just drag one on, I could just drag it on and use it and it would work. And actually that is the beauty of everything in Azure ML, is that you want to do this kind of thing. You want to be able to, you want to have a service. What this is doing is it's building a web service that, given somebody writes a number, it tells you what number it thinks that is. And that's not an easy problem to solve. And this just does it for you. And you don't really need to do anything. I could just drag this on, connect it up to these training, these data sets, and it will be a pretty good, it will actually be pretty good at figuring out that that was a 6 or that was a 9. So that's what I mean about, you don't really need to be a rocket surgeon to use this stuff. You just drag it on, drop it, connect it up, and it works. The topic though is NetSharp, so I'll try and get rid of that. What you can also do is you can code NetSharp in here, and this is about the simplest piece of NetSharp coding you can do. And actually, it's pretty much exactly the same as the multi-class neural net that you drag and drop on, and gives you pretty much the same results. It just says, okay, we're going to be getting pictures coming in, and they're 28 by 28 pixels. Then we're going to have 100 nodes in a single layer that's going to process these. And then what we want is we want to classify the results into 10 different classes. And the softmax is saying that we don't care about the details. We just want to know whether you think you found this number in that input picture. So that's the very, that's the simplest program. That's hello world in NetSharp. And that is basically my limit. Well, almost, you know. Now, if you really want to do something, so the first thing, if you really want to do something, my advice is see if somebody's already done it for you, because it can get quite difficult. So that takes you 10 minutes, right? Coding that up. Well, it takes you 1 second if you just grab the shape and drop it onto the design surface. But if you really want accuracy, you need something like this. And this is pretty much a standard model. And the model that we're talking about is in here. So just click it. This is a starting to be serious. Oh, come on. This is a starting to be serious NetSharp application. Define a bunch of constants, right? That's all we're doing here. Then we're going to input some kind of picture. Now, the actual height and width of the picture we're going to input is a constant, it's a constant. That's defined further up. And then we're going to have a convolution layer. I don't even want to talk about what that does, right? basically, that's going to, what that first layer is going to do is it's going to, like, look at little sections of that image coming through, just scan over little sections of that image looking for something, let's say Wally. Or at this level, like if we're talking about building a machine that can find Wally in a Where's Wally picture, this first layer would be looking for red and white stripes. Right? That's what it's going to do. We don't have to tell it that, it's just probably what it does. And then that's going to find things that's interesting, and they're going to be passed to this layer, which is going to get all of the, it's going to get all of the inputs from the previous layer, and I'm lost already. Okay, so you get the general idea. So this is, I'm trying to read a NetSharp program without really being able to read a NetSharp program, so I'll stop. But in order to do some real work, you need to know the language. But it's not that hard, right? It's not that hard. You need to know the theories. You need to know what sort of things you want to do. You want to know why you want to do convolution. You need to know what functions to use. These are all using the default sigmoid functions, which are sort of like just weighted and weighted feedback loops, but you can use different functions, or I think you can even write your own functions if you're really advanced. Let's go back to what is it that you should you should take from this. NetSharp is actually a really cool thing. This is really the only DSL that helps. Is anybody from the University of Waikato? Good. NetSharp is really the only domain-specific language that lets you do this. There are other tools that let you build neural nets, but they don't have a DSL, and that makes it very, very powerful. So let's get out of here or get to talking. I got to my finally slide. So basically, these tools that Microsoft provides allow me, without really knowing that much about the underlying technologies, use those technologies and the complexities. I have to understand a certain amount. I really have to become a trained operator. I have to learn how to use these tools. I don't really want to spend large parts of my life understanding how to build effective deep neural nets. I got better things to do with my time. But I'm quite happy that somebody else does it, and when they do, I will reuse it. And I also know that if I've got a neural net, say defined in NetSharp, that does one thing, that if I take it and point it at another similar problem, it will probably just work, and train it, now I've got to give it training data, it will probably just work. So if they give you sample code like that one, that's sample code that's reasonably good at detecting things and images, I could probably take that sample code and just use it on Where's Wally, and it will probably just work. I could build my Wally detector in a couple of days just by reusing somebody else's work, as in that deep convoluted neural net defined by that NetSharp code that we were looking at. It would probably help if I actually understood the language, which I don't, only a little bit. So, so that's the neural net stuff. And of course, there are the tools that are just there. Like, remember right at the beginning, the text sentiment analysis. It was just get some text, call it. It'll tell you whether it's happy or sad or positive or negative, right? You just use this stuff. You don't try and do it yourself. You just use it. And the rate of these Project Oxford APIs are actually proving to be a really good, they're very popular, and because they're popular, they're making more of them. So Microsoft is providing more and more of these all the time, and the rate of change is increasing. So, whereas the team might have started off as 10 people, and I don't really know how big the team is, and now it's 200, it might be 2,000 next year, because people like this kind of thing. So, that's pretty much it for male, age 42, happy. And I've got about the right amount of time to answer questions. Yes? Pretty close. 9 minutes over. Okay, right. Thank you for listening. And I'll hang around here for 10 minutes. Actually, I can take questions while with the mic on, if anybody wants to do that. Not necessarily going to be able to answer them. No? Okay, thanks everybody.